Hello and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And do you want to do one of those like 30 seconds previously on Condensed History Gems?
Previously on Condensed History Gems, we were talking about William the Conqueror before he was William the Conqueror. Now we're going to look at him after he's done the conquering and got an entire new country to look after. So, Gregory, initial thoughts?
I don't know. Well, my first thought is that was less of... I was going for more of the American sort of style previously on this show, whereas you went more for... This week on Top Gear, we've got anyway, so my immediate thought is last week you started off by saying that if you mentioned William the Conqueror, people would have one thing in their head. And I think it's very true to say if people mention William the Conqueror, one thing will be the first thing that pops into their head. But I'm going to stick my neck out here. I've not actually done a proper survey. But my guess is if you ask people to name three things associated with William the Conqueror, and particularly people in England I'm going for now, they would say Battle of Hastings, obviously. They'd probably get to the Doomsday Book, which obviously is a major piece of work. And the third thing would be Motton Bailey Castles, because they did a project of one at school and vaguely remember it has something to do with William the Conqueror. Because
My nephew right now is doing a Motton Bailey Castle design, and my sister was saying how much she so doesn't care about Motton Bailey Castles.
This is fascinating. This might not be something that the rest of the world... You know, this is a cultural thing that's really, really English, I think, is the fact that one of the rites of passage for... English students is at some point during their time in school, they're going to study Battle of Hastings, and for some reason the study of Battle of Hastings has become synonymous with now go away and build a model of a Motton Bailey castle out of usually paper mache and lollipop sticks, I think.
Ah, yes, so, lollipop sticks.
Any of our international, you know, do if anyone has photographs of your Motton Bailey castles that you've made, then do share them to History Gems Twitter feed, whatever you do, at History Gems, and Jem will share them on to me, but I want to flood Jem's Twitter feed this week with photographs of Motton Bailey Castle models.
Oh, I'd love that. That'd be great. It would be fantastic.
I'd love that to cover your Twitter feed this week. So we got Motton Bailey Castles, but I think the big crucial one there is the Doomsday Book. Would you agree that's sort of the biggest thing?
I mean, that is an absolute gold mine from the point of view of historians. But that's right at the end of his reign. We need to rewind. In terms of the Motton Bailey castles, just a couple of things on that. What's interesting is that we know that he brought over from Normandy basically a sort of flak pack version of the wooden Motton Bailey. So the Motton Bailey castle is the most simple form of castle, which there were literally hundreds of them by the end of his reign erected, and they were basically all wooden. Some of them got rebuilt into stone, which is what the White Tower in the Tower of London is. You could argue it's a fossilized Bailey, but anyway, let's not get too het up into that. But the thing is, castles are we did a whole podcast about these, but castles are where a feudal lord lived. If you have to live in a fortification, that tells you something about the state of civil unrest at the time, and there could be no doubt that the new Norman aristocracy had to suppress, through violence, the local Anglo-Saxon English people. And so therefore, that's why all these castles popped up. Every castle in Britain has to post-date 1066. That's not the same thing as were there fortifications before. Of course there were. There was the Burr system to stop the Vikings. They were built in the Anglo-Saxon era. Also, sometimes you get things misappropriated as castles, like you get Maiden Castle, which is an Iron Age hill fort. But that is very different to a castle. It's also an awful lot bigger than a castle. But anyway, so castles are a physical symbol of the Norman conquest of England. And in Wales, you know, we tend to think about Edward I as conquering Wales, but actually it started with William the Conqueror, and there were the Marcher Lords who lived on the borders of Wales, and pretty much every campaigning system, they kind of march 10 miles further, I'm going to do it, west is the direction I'm going for, and then set up another castle. So there are a disproportionate amount of castles in Wales because it was the best way to sort of conquer that area, which wasn't initially conquered like England was. But the thing I loved from 1066 is William got crowned King of England. So October the 14th is when the Battle of Hastings happened, but he gets crowned King of England in London, in Westminster, and he's there in the Abbey on Christmas Day 1066. So it's a couple of months later, and it was a tense affair. There were soldiers positioned everywhere. One eyewitness said that William looked visibly sort of shaken and nervous as he sat there on the throne. And when the peasants, because they were trying to, I guess, ingratiate themselves to the Normans, when it was announced that he'd been crowned inside, they did a huge cheer celebrating this moment. I'm not entirely sure how happy they were, but the Normans mistook that for a riot and so responded with it with violence. So, you know, people died during the coronation of William in December 1066. It did not go well, it's fair to say, and some people saw this as an omen of, oh, this is only going to get worse for William. And indeed, the idea that Battle of Hastings, done, dusted, now all of England is definitely now Norman, it didn't work like that. William had to put down a number of rebellions. Some of the most dangerous ones were up in Northumbria, which led to the harrowing of the North, which, I again, it's something that tends to get taught in schools. I'm wondering, you know, I've, as always, thrown a whole bunch of facts your way. Any opinions or thoughts on what I've been saying there? And indeed, do you know much about the harrowing of the North, Greg?
Well, the first thing that springs to mind is when you're talking about the castles, you said about the building the castle and building a lot of castles kind of gives you an idea of the state of civil unrest. And I think to a certain extent that when we're talking specifically about our good old favourite Mott and Bailey castles, that actually adds another level to that, because of course the whole thing about Mott and Bailey is where you've got the raised keep and the walled lower section, what you're actually preparing for with a Mott and Bailey castle is a first level of retreat. You're actually preparing to have everyone pull back to the keep if the front, if the outer walls get breached. And in fact, I know that happened in our local castle here on the Isle of Wight, Carisbrook Castle, when they found out that actually they dug both the wells to the same depth, which is a bit of a problem, because if you've built one castle on a hill and one not on a hill, they soon found out that the castle, the main keep, the well wasn't actually deep enough, and they very quickly had to surrender. But that's one thing. And when you continue to say about the unrest at the coronation, we're moving on to the harrowing of the North in a minute, which I'm going to gloss over because I actually know very little about it. And when we talk about the unrest, it is one of those things that 1066 is this huge deadline date in our mind. And it's a little bit like saying D-Day, or saying the signing of the armistice, or Waterloo, or any of these sort of key battles that people kind of seal off in their mind as the end of the war. That was, you know, this is where it finished, this is the final stand, you know, Hitler's suicide in the bunker in World War II, this is when it ended. You know, take it up right, as you know, sort of right up to 1990, the fall of the Berlin Wall. Coming forward in history, people look at the fall of the Berlin Wall as, ah, okay, that's where the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, that's where Russia opened up and everyone. And the fact of the matter is, it's never true that a single battle is going to immediately resolve all problems. Same as the crowning of a king in general, you know, when we've had a disputed bloodline, you can't just stick a crown on William's head. It is not a, I was going to use a very silly comparison there, actually, because I was going to say it's not a King Arthur moment where he draws a sword from the stone and everyone bows down to him. But of course, that's straight away me falling into the same trap, because if you read the Arthur legends, when Arthur pulls the sword from the stone, that's not the case of everyone immediately goes, oh, he's pulled a sword from the stone, he must be king. He, again, in the legends, has to fight off rebellion. So I think I think your point is a very good one, and it's important to remember that a pivotal battle, even though he's defeated the enemy, it's not ever going to be as simple as, right, that's it, we've done this battle, so everyone agree. That would be, you know, to use a sports metaphor that I know nothing about, that would be like if, I don't know, West Ham United won the football competition, and so all the fans of the other teams went, oh, West Ham won, they obviously are the best, let's all swap our allegiance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, is the simple answer. So what happened is, in going up north, there was another claimant to the throne. He was rather young at the time of 1066, which is why he wasn't considered. But by 1069, he was sort of, I guess, a teenager by then. And this is Edgar the Etheling. So he was a very young man. He was a member of the old Anglo-Saxon royal dynasty, and is at his... descendant tried suing the royal family. This is in the 1990s, saying, hey, hang on, I've got a better claim to the throne than you guys do. But of course, that's not how history works, okay? So a number of Anglo-Saxon lords rose up. There was particularly strong resistance in the north because that was farthest away from the power base, and obviously they could look to potentially to Scotland, which had some pretty good relations. Prior to the events of 1066, sort of into the 1050s, the king of Scotland was this guy called Macbeth. It's a real guy. However, by now it was Malcolm III. Let's just not get too into Scottish era, dynasties or anything. But the point is, so you had Scotland potentially backing some of the Anglo-Saxons who were rising up. And in 1069 to 1070, William sent his army north, and he went north as well. And basically underwent a period of sort of scorched earth policy. Any kind of resistance, even the vaguest temptation, we think potentially these are suspected rebels, would have been killed. Crops were destroyed. Populations were denuded. And you can still see this in the Doomsday Book, which was written in the 1080s. So more than a decade later, you can see the damage from this ravaging of the north of England at this time. How can you see it? Because the populations don't seem to be big enough for certain towns and things like that. So in other words, they're still suffering from, the murders and massacres and burnings that happen. So the Harrying of the North is a really sort of nice name for something that was absolutely horrific and wicked, but can it be in any way surprising from a man who had been kind of fighting for his place in the world since the age of 7?
It's not surprising, but what therefore might be a little bit surprising is what happens to him next. So he fights all his resistance, but then we're going to move on to the Doomsday Book, where he makes this huge record. And it's interesting to me that William is known for two things. One is, I'm leaving Motton Bailey Castles out as something a bit facetious, but the first thing William is really known for is the Battle of Hastings, this great big battle. And then the second thing he's known for is the Doomsday Book, this incredible historical record and document. And obviously, in its time, it was an administrative document, one of the biggest and most important administrative documents, I think, that we have as a historical thing in England. And the idea that we don't very often get through history kings and rulers who are real warriors, but also real administrators as well. There are a few we get through history, but to have those two sides taken care of and really looked into. One of my big things with this is, obviously the Doomsday Book, I think most of the way that the Doomsday Book actually comes up in a public sphere rather than an academic, a studying sphere, is the number of places where I perform or I visit historic buildings and things, and so often you will find part of their gumph listed in the Doomsday Book. you know, this site goes back to the Doomsday Book. This was earliest recorded in the Doomsday Book. This was written in the Doomsday Book. And it's like places... It's like saying, you know, I won this award or something. You know, it's this is this. And really, it's, you know, really, it is a case of he wrote a list of everywhere in the country. You're saying, you know, it gives credence to the age of the place, but there's a lot of places a lot older that still hold up, but we were listed in the Doomsday Book as this major achievement because it is a document.
Four stars in the Doomsday Book.
Exactly. It's exactly what it feels like. But it is... It's a document, and I think really, Doomsday Book, Magna Carta, how many other, you know, documents from that far, you know, would everybody have some idea what it is?
Oh,
I'm trying to think of another one. Possibly Anglo-Saxon Chronicles at a push.
Yeah, but you're quite right. So the thing about the Doomsday Book, well, first of all, how did it get its name? And the answer is Book of Revelations, because it said that, you know, before Doomsday, before the end of days, the apocalypse, everything will be recorded and written down. And that's what it felt like to the Anglo-Saxons. They'd never had this level of granular detail, as we'd use today as a phrase, happening. And the reason why William did this is because he was new. He didn't know how what's the tax revenues for York. He didn't know. How many people live in Norwich? No idea. So, you know, this was his chance to work out what was owed by whom, by where, and also to settle potential legal disputes. He's bringing in his generals, and they get to be the Anglo-Norman aristocracy. So if I'm going to give X Buckinghamshire, well, where's the borders of that then? So, you know, to actually get all this stuff down on paper was incredibly important in terms of judicial... I'm trying to think of the phrase and it's gone out of my head, but basically to stop legal arguments before they've even begun, because it's now a matter of record. That's the phrase I was looking for. So that's really interesting. But just sort of to rewind, I was told this story a long time ago. I don't know where its origins are, and certainly I don't know whether it was ever specifically written down as his intent, but it's certainly the way things happened. That allegedly, William, when he moved over, obviously he knows how Normandy's run, so he was very keen to use Norman systems in England, but he paused. And I use this actually in my day-to-day training, because quite often when you get a new manager or a new divisional director, the first thing they want to do is stamp their authority. And it's like, the old ways are the old ways. That's the way Dave did it. I'm not Dave. And to prove to everybody I'm not Dave, I'm going to throw away everything Dave did and we're going to do it my way. Well, if Dave had been running that team for 10 years, I'm sure there are some things that could be changed. And the phrase, the reason why we do this is because it's the way it's always been done, is usually a sign of inefficiency. But also, if somebody was doing it for 10 years, they've picked up on other efficiencies. So you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And apparently, well, certainly what William didn't do is just ship over everything, all Norman law, immediately. He waited. He waited to see how England worked. And funnily enough, a kingdom has more resources and therefore is likely to be better run than a duchy that had been in civil war for the last 15 years. And so, actually, you know, yes, the feudal system came in. Who owned the land changed. But an awful lot of law remained the same. So there's sort of a myth. Although the society did change and there were big breaks with Anglo-Saxon England, if you want to see how the tax revenues were generated, you know, the basis of law was basically the same, because it was already working. Why change it? So Doomsday Book was really another layer on this rather practical way of how do you run a country you've just got?
That's true. And one of the fun little consequences of the Battle of Hastings and of Norman rule, which I think kind of sums up in a way your point that some things change and some things stay the same, which I may have mentioned before on a podcast, and this is something that I haven't 100% fact-checked, but it's an origins of word sort of thing, which is always a little bit complicated and a bit contentious, but it's one of the interesting ones, which is the names of meat that people eat. Now, I say people, I'm vegetarian these days, but we have meat, we have things like chicken, we have rabbit, and if you eat chicken or rabbit, the animal is called chicken and the meat is called chicken. If you eat rabbit, the animal's called rabbit, the meat is called rabbit. Whereas, if you eat a pig, we call it pork. If you eat a cow, we call it beef. And this is one of my favourite little things where odd little things like this, and you think, well, hang on, why do we have different names for some types of meat and not others? And my understanding of it is this dates right back to the Norman Conquest, and it's the idea that beef and pork, cow and pig, would be eaten by richer households. They would likely to be eaten by the Norman lords, and therefore, when they're turned into their food form, they were referred to by the French words, which were, beef, which, you know, Teresa can have a lot of fun with me trying to pronounce that, yes, as well. Whereas the lower classes, they would have been eating the smaller animals. They would have been having the chicken and the rabbit, things like that. And so they stuck with the Anglo-Saxon words for those things. And I think, again, this kind of shows how there is a division. And yes, probably things did change, but a lot of what changes, and I think the same is probably true, actually, of the Roman invasion and a lot of the changes happen in that top level where the new lords are being instilled and sort of drifting down to sort of next level or two, whereas at the base level, things tend not to change an awful lot. Your basic, as you say, your basic man in the field, as it were, still going out toiling his fields every day, as we mentioned last. He doesn't care, you know, whether he's an English or a Norman or a Viking or whatever. He just cares. Basically, his only concern is, one, that he gets to eat, and two, that, oh, good, this is a period where there's not an army rampaging across the country, killing everybody at this point in time, so I can have a bit of peace and quiet. That they aren't changing their everything massively as a new regime comes in. And yet, at the top, obviously, things do start to change, and people try and keep in, and fashions change usually from the top down.
Absolutely. I'm sort of aware that times are ticking on this one. So just a couple of other things. First of all, we get the Bayeux tapestry. Now, it's not a tapestry because tapestries are basically like rugs. So it's actually an embroidery, and it wasn't made in Bayeux. It was pretty much definitively made in England. But apart from that, it's a great name for the Bayeux tapestry there. But that seems to have been made by William's half-brother, Bishop Odo, and it seems to have been made about a decade after the events of 1066. It is clearly Norman propaganda, but it's really useful for us in terms... So, I mean, you know, unusually for these sort of warrior kings, as you've already said, it's kind of weird that a sort of a military style general would leave a number of legacies that aren't military. So, you know, the Bayeux tapestry, you know, William didn't commission it, but it was given to him as a kind of present, and it certainly would, it's William's point of view. And I don't think the Battle of Hastings would be nearly as well remembered if it wasn't for this wonderful visual representation of the events of that year. And then you've also got the Doomsday book too. And what's interesting is that by the 1080s, clearly William felt secure enough in England to leave England and go back to Normandy. You know, it's unlikely that the north of England's going to erupt in revolt, if I'm going to trust that, which is why I'm going to, head over the English Channel, which was not a guaranteed thing. It was dangerous. But, you know, there have been a number of occasions in English history where key people have drowned in the English Channel. So, you know, heading back there's a little bit of a risk factor there. But also, you're a long way away from somewhere like York, for example, and therefore, it's a sign that things are going quite well. And what's interesting is the last few years of his reign, not a lot's written. So a number of historians think the reason for that is because not a lot of note was happening. You know, there were no rebellions to write about. And it's a bit like when you're catching up with a friend you haven't seen for a couple of years. And you go, how are things? And you realise that when you summarise all the good things in your life, you get a couple of paragraphs. You know, how are the kids? They're all fine. But, you know, if little Jimmy's broken their arm, that's a whole huge story. So actually the fact there isn't a lot written about William's last few years is a sign that things by then had pretty much settled down. But the, well, okay, the funny thing is, William the Conqueror is the only English king to have exploded. What happened was, towards his last few years, is he wasn't really in the saddle anymore. He did love eating. He got very, very fat. And when he died, so he, to be fair, he exploded after he died. But when he died, he was put into an airtight coffin, and his digestive juices, his sort of decompositioning juices, led to him basically bursting in the coffin. But just before that, what I find really interesting is we all assume he's the King of England. You know, he surely that's the best thing he could aspire to. But he had three sons. And I know we've talked a little bit about this in the past. But his eldest son, Robert, you would think he gets to be King of England. But no, he was made Duke of Normandy. In William's mind, the eldest son gets the family jewels, as it were, and that's Normandy. Son number two, William, also called William, he gets to be King of England. So from that point, England and Normandy are split again as separate entities. But it's actually son number three, Henry, who manages in 1100 to sort of weld them back again with dodgy means, which we've gone into another podcast. So actually, what William's plan was when he died was not to keep Normandy and England as a unified power, but that's what happened kind of a decade or so after his death.
And so with the death of William, I think, and with the time moving forward the way it is, we have actually managed, I think, to do a fairly good job over these two podcasts, plus the Battle of Hastings podcast, to actually finish a topic. Obviously, we can never finish a topic, but for us, I feel like we've actually done William the Conqueror now. I think we can actually put a tick in that.
Yeah, there are other things we could talk about, but you know, yes, you're right. And hopefully what this has shown over these two podcasts is there's an awful lot more to the man than just 1066.
Indeed, I think we've definitely shown that. There was also the Motton Bailey Castles. I think that was, okay.
Very important, Motton Bailey Castles,
so,
yes.
So don't forget, my little plug for this week, I'm gonna go first if you don't mind, Jem. My little plug for this week is at HistoryGems on Twitter. Go to at HistoryGems and post any pictures you have of Motton Bailey Castles you made as a kid or your kids have made or any other pictures you can find of models of Motton Bailey Castles. Jen, what do you want to plug this week?
Yeah, bring them on is all I'm going
to
say. I'd love
to
see pictures of this stuff.
This so
in fact,
much.
I'm going to demand like my sister sends a picture of what her son's, my nephew's Motton Bailey Castle looks like. I'm sure it's being built as we speak. Anyway, wrap this up, Greg.
Okay, did you want to make a plug before we go?
No, that was my plug.
That was your
bring
plug.
Bring on the Motton Bailey Castles.
In that case, thank you very much to all of you for listening. My one little plug that I'm sticking on the end of all of these ones, a little extra, is please help support creators like me and Jem, not just by buying stuff we produce, but most importantly, if you enjoy a podcast or a book or a video or anything else online, take just a few moments to comment, to share it, to review it. Takes a couple of minutes of your time, but it does us all the good in the world. That includes making sure you pop over to wherever you're listening to this podcast now and just writing a little review of this podcast and what you enjoy about it. But for now, of course, thank you so much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And we'll be back next week not talking about William the Conqueror. So for now, goodbye and take care.